Connecticut Today for the first Monday in July, July 6th, featured Charlie Wynn in the 3 o'clock hour, a congressional candidate from Colorado who tipped us off to a pandemic exercise that was run just a few months before COVID-19 broke in Connecticut and all around the country. In the 4 o'clock hour, we gave you portions of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus update. The big news there, phase 3 of the reopening has been delayed. And in the 5 o'clock hour, Francine Nido joined us. She heads the Waterbury chapter of Unico, a national Italian-American fraternal organization. Unico Waterbury offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the capture and conviction of anybody who was involved in the recent vandalism of the Christopher Columbus statue in Waterbury. Dr. Charlie Wynn is the guest. Charlie, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
How are you doing, Paul? Doing well out here in Colorado.
How is it? How is the rarefied air of Colorado doing these days?
Well, it's clear, sunny, and I'm loving it.
I could tell you probably are, Charlie. You have quite the medical background, hooked into a military background. Talk a little about that.
Well, I went into the Navy in 1969 during Vietnam, and was assigned most of the time to the Western Pacific as a flight surgeon. Mm-hmm. But I also got to be a diving medical officer and traveled all over Southeast Asia, got all the way to Afghanistan in 1972. So I had quite a tour.
Afghanistan of the early 70s, that must have been something. Was it a tad different than it is today?
Well, I haven't been back recently, but I can tell you it was a pretty big surprise. We hadn't expected to see what we saw. Mm-hmm. And it was, unfortunately for the people of Afghanistan, it was just the start as the Russians were beginning to move in.
Yeah.
And Afghanistan was going through a very, very difficult time. So it was quite different. I think that we have to look back and see as these people have been at war for so long, they don't know. No one over there knows what it's like to be without war.
So to the present day, Charlie, fast forward, you're a retired physician after a long career doing that. You're running for Congress. And I was reading something you wrote regarding, you know, Congress's role and the government's role, at least in your mind, Charlie, about what we're seeing today in the COVID-19, the response or lack thereof. And from what I can tell, Charlie, from what you wrote, you seem to think Congress may have dropped the ball a bit on this. Talk about that.
I don't want to point fingers at any one person. We've been knowing a pandemic was going to come forever. Certainly, when I was in medical school, the Hong Kong flu hit, and over 100,000 Americans died. And worldwide, we don't really know how many, but someplace between 1 and 3 million people died. So we've known this year coming for a long time. Each administration, unfortunately, has not done enough to make a difference. And then what I was talking about in that article is that under the Trump administration and under HHS, they decided we need to find out how prepared we were. And they came up with a scenario, an exercise called Crimson Contagion. What they did was the scenario was a tourist would arrive from China with an airborne virus. It'd land in Chicago. And how prepared were we for this novel virus? The scenario sounds awfully familiar to what we ran into in January. But what was determined in this exercise is that we were very poorly prepared. We hadn't been spending enough money consistently to get into viral research, treatments for viral diseases. We had a very haphazard, that's the only way I can describe it, public health response to it, with very little communication and very little response as far as providing supplies to the local areas. And it was determined that in a pandemic, we didn't have the supplies we needed because our supply lines came from overseas, and in a pandemic, this would be shut down. And I'll have to ask you, do you think this sounds awfully familiar? So we were warned about it, and Congress was given this report, especially the House of Representatives, and they didn't respond. It didn't seem to be that important. So So, yes, we all share in this, but I do have to say that the Trump administration was the first administration that really looked at the problem and tried to determine what we would do in the response.
Yeah,
I'm not
going
to point fingers at any one person. We've certainly had decades to deal with this. But when the evidence was presented to the House of Representatives, it was sort of a ho-hum. This can never happen again. There will be another pandemic. They come around. That's the way viruses work. And we need to make sure that we're clearly prepared next time so we don't go through what we've gone through in the last 6 months.
Yeah, Charlie, I see that here, this crimson contagion that you talk about. This ran from January of last year, this exercise. This wasn't a 1 or 2 week thing, a 1, 2, or 3 week thing. This was 8 months here. So you're right. You would think after an 8 month exercise, at least in my mind, Charlie, and I'm completely uneducated on this, more people would have paid attention after 8 months.
I think you're right, sir. You're as educated as anybody else, apparently. And what bothered me is that the House of Representatives was busy trying to impeach a duly elected president, and they took their eye off the ball. Certainly were not doing the people's business. It looked like they were doing more petty partisan politicking rather than the people's business. This is the House of Representatives is the people's house. They weren't doing the people's business.
So, Charlie, if you're elected, I mean, how would a first-term House member, which is what you would be. Now, you do have your medical background, and there are other physicians in both the House or Senate who have your background. How do you rattle the cages amongst these people, Charlie, to pay more attention to this stuff, which, as you say, has been warned about for decades?
Well, the first thing I do is get on radio stations like yours and start telling the story and getting people interested. I want the people to be aware of what happened. The people will tell Congress what to do. We have to make sure we change the narrative that's coming out of Washington now and tell Congress, do the people's business. Do not ever let us be this vulnerable again. It was horrible that we didn't address this issue long ago. After all, in 2009, we had the swine flu. Mm-hmm. It was another ho-hum, in spite of the fact that the president then, Obama, did say, are we in danger of having a horrible pandemic? Fortunately, he was able to dodge the bullet. His administration was, and the people of America were. But why wasn't more done then? He had a chance to do this exercise, this crimson contagion. He failed to do it. It was only under the Trump administration that finally somebody sat down and said, you know, we better be sure we're protected. Now, again, I try not to point fingers at any one person, but we've been warned over and over and over again. We need to have people in Washington that understand the problem, can really do the people's business. As I've said, I retired a couple of years ago from medicine. I had a very satisfying career. I would be going to Washington because I want to get a hold of the people there that do have a voice and make sure we're louder. And we make sure that people's business is done, and we don't just get into party politics. I'm certainly not in this for party politics.
The website is winforcolorado.com. That's win with two N's, W-I-N-N for Colorado.com. Dr. Charlie Wynn has been the guest. Charlie, thank you. Good luck. Take care of yourself, and hopefully we can speak in the future. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, check it out, winforcolorado.com. I had no idea of this Operation Crimson Contagion, or this, I guess you would term it, a statistical exercise. I'm reading about it here. So thanks to Charlie Wynn for telling me about that.
Here, this is the numbers since Friday, so it's a three-day aggregate. And what you got to know is the numbers continue to trend in the right direction, which is not true of 38 other states around the country. So we should be thankful for that. I think what's interesting is we've had 259 positive cases over 3 days. I would say that probably Arizona had 10 times that number of cases test positive in 1 day. Florida had 30 or 40 times that number test positive over the course of 1 day. Hospitalizations down dramatically over 3 days as well. That number cannot go down indefinitely, but that's a good trend. And tests performed, you'll see it's about 8,000 a day, 56,000 or so for the week on a weekly basis. You can sort of see where the trends are there. And that's a pretty good number given the fact we have so many fewer people who feel symptomatic, so they're a little less likely to get tested. But we are seeing around the rest of the country, people are lining up to get tested again as they see their infection rates pick up. So I think this is a good time for people to take advantage of our capacity. The testing overview, I think this is something you've seen many times before, and the good news is the moving averages are down below 1%. We are down, I think it's 0.7%, less than 1% of everybody tested positive. That's over the last 7 days. That's better than any state except for Vermont, is my understanding. And thank you for taking the protocol seriously. When you have so many fewer people testing positive, means that we're able to really stay on top of contact tracing. That said, we're ready if there were some sort of a surge as well. We've got, this is per Josh, we've got 100% of our local health departments are now engaged, uploading information to the cloud, making the calls on a regular basis. 885 people signed up to do contact tracing. 120 of them are volunteers. Most are from our local health departments. Some are from our state health department to provide support to the locals. We're now responding to 96% of all those cases we reach out to within 48 hours. So I think that's really good. But less than half of them are successfully contacted. Maybe if there is a party, maybe there's some sort of an event, maybe you just don't want people to know. And our job and the contact tracing people, why we call, why we don't just do it electronically, is to tell you if you care about your friends, you care about your family, let us know so we can keep them safe. And if you get a text that reads CT COVID trace, respond. The next, just want to give you a brief update on what's going on around the rest of the country. This is from the Houston Chronicle. I mentioned last week that their notice to people for July 4th weekend was stay home. I think this is yesterday, where they said, what happened? How did we get here? They had such a low positivity rate. And let's not get too big for our britches. They had a very low rate just 3 months ago in Connecticut, in New York, and in New Jersey, were, you know, represented well over half or 40% of all the positivity. Now those shoes are on the other foot. But I wanted to say one more thing about why we are going to pause phase three. At this point, I look at Arizona, I look at Florida, in this case, I look at Texas, and we're sort of reverting to the mean, as Josh would say, by which I mean that, 1 second on that, Max. By which I mean, we never opened up our bars, and now they are slowly they're going back and not opening, they're closing down their bars. And you saw, as Governor Greg Abbott said, you know, I regret having opened the bars at all because they are so conducive to the infection. And I think that was a good thing we did. Otherwise, we never opened our restaurants to more than 50% capacity. That's what these other states are going to be doing now as well. They were at 75% or more before. We had said maybe we consider larger gatherings for outside. I think let's take a pause on that. Let's keep to 25 people inside. Hopefully it's a group of people that you know and feel comfortable with, and 100 people outside where it's much easier to social distance. We've learned one thing, it's how much safer outdoors is than indoors. We had talked a little bit about perhaps raising the capacity for lots of different entertainment venues and gyms and restaurants beyond 50%. We're going to keep that at 50% for the foreseeable future. We're just erring on the side of caution, as we've said before. We see what's going on in other states, and I think it's really important that we maintain that. The next chart just gives you an idea of this is what happened at Fort Myers. And we can have a lot of guidance, we can have a lot of protocols, but the only work if people follow our guidance. As you know, we said early on, 15 feet between blankets on a beach, it's not working in other parts of the country. It's not working in other parts of the country where people, took their eye off the ball and relaxed their guard. This is Fort Myers just 2 days ago. And let me contrast that with Hammonasset Beach. This is Hammonasset Beach right here in Madison, Connecticut, where I think we capped the number of people that can be at the beach. Social distancing is easier, and that's keeping us safe. That's keeping our metrics headed in the right direction. And as you look around the rest of the country, you see a big majority of states ramping up. You see that we had three of the worst days for infection since July 1, since the start of the pandemic. Three of the six worst days have been in July alone. It tells you that we have a lot of work to do, and thankfully Connecticut's doing it in a very thoughtful way. You know, with that, Paul and Josh are here to answer any questions, and so am I.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. Regarding July 8th for state campgrounds, is that still a go or is that on pause now?
That's still a go.
And you said, I just want to be clear on this, you said that you're not going to expand capacity for outdoor venues, you were keeping it at 50%. I thought it was 25% and that 50% was going to be for phase three. Am I incorrect in that?
Depends on the location.
Yeah, the 25% limit for large outdoor facilities that have a fire code associated with them, for example, racetracks, are going to stay at 25%.
Got it. And what needs to happen? What metric does the state need to meet for bars to reopen and for other phase three plans to happen? Because I imagine that a lot of bars, they're saying, look, Connecticut's been doing the right thing. We open very slowly. We're taking the right precautions. We should be allowed to open.
I think I'm taking a lot of guidance from our neighboring states, not just our neighboring states, but states around the country. I've had occasion to talk to some of the other governors as well. And they've been pretty blunt and I think gracious in saying, look, maybe we should have done this a different way, because standing up bar at the bar is not a good way to socially distance. They were not able to control it. Texas opened up. They had to close down, dozens of bars before they closed them all down because it was very, very difficult to enforce. So I think we're going to be cautious on this one.
Are there any indications on when they would reopen? Would we have to wait for a vaccine?
Let's wait and see. We'll be looking around the rest of the country. We'll be looking at our neighboring states to see if we reach a point where we think we can do it safely. Look, I like a beer at the bar as much as the next person. I know how frustrating this can be, but right now, with this pandemic flaring up in a majority of other states, this is not the time to take a risk.
Thank you.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, on Thursday you said that your biggest concern for the weekend was people coming in from highly infected states. Do you have a sense of how that went this weekend?
I think we're going to get another set of numbers tomorrow, but I did talk to a number of the airlines. This is the end of last week, where I can tell you that maybe 50% increase in, or double the number of cancellations that they had anticipated. A number of flights have been canceled, so there are many fewer people coming from Florida, Arizona, South Carolina, now even California, than there were before. Max has pointed out to me that we did do advertising on social media in Florida, Arizona, and Texas. We've had over 1 million impressions on that. So I think people know that this region, not just Connecticut, is being very strict on the quarantining, and it's discouraging a lot of out-of-state visitation from those states.
So when it comes to that quarantine, are there any plans on increasing the enforcement beyond just the request to voluntarily do it?
We will if we have to, but I don't think so at this point. I like the fact that people are self-quarantining by perhaps not coming. That was number one. Number two, we've certainly been clear, and I think people have gotten the message, this is what the rules are. All the advertising at Bradley Airport, not to mention Kennedy and LaGuardia, where people actually have to sign a form when they land, saying what their plans are for quarantining. So far, so good, I think.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, you've answered a couple of my questions, but I do want to ask you two things. You talked about in other areas, bars opening and now having to close. Do you think one of the maybe other things that has happened that has gone wrong elsewhere was people being kind of lax in enforcing the restrictions? And then secondly, based on everything and hitting the pause button here, will you also try and expedite COVID testing at Bradley?
Well, first of all, when it comes to enforcement, I think I mentioned that Texas had shut down dozens of bars before they had to go back and say all bars are going to be closed. I think you remember us saying probably a month or so ago, we're trying to be cautious because we don't want to have to backtrack. We don't want to open something and have to close it. So I think that's still going to be what we want to do. In terms of testing, as you know, we've said, look, folks, before you get on the airplane in Miami, get a test 72 hours in advance. I don't know of any plans to do anything at Bradley at this point, Josh.
No, I don't think there's a single airport in the country that's doing testing at the airport. We have 135 testing sites in Connecticut, so anyone who needs a test can, it doesn't have to travel far to get one. I would add to the governor's comments, though, we have stepped up with the airlines. We now have each airline reading our PSA to all passengers.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, will there be state funding available to support the social distancing requirements for reopening schools, such as PPE and the barriers that will have to be put up and stepped up cleaning?
The answer is yes, Sue. We've got, I believe it's over $100 million has been distributed to the schools already out of these are federal funds, and now Melissa McCaw, OPM, is taking a look at what the needs of our schools are going to be. That's why last week we gave each and every one of the schools and the superintendents what our protocols were in terms of social distancing, in terms of cohorting, in terms of cleaning, in terms of plastic sheets. They are going to come back to us, give us their best idea of how to implement it, and what they think that might cost. And I'll be able to get back to you. I think it's about 2 or 3 weeks that we'll have all that information and see whether we can afford to support all this. But they will be getting state support to make this happen.
And sort of along those lines, too, September can be really hot. And I'm told most classrooms have maybe one fan, and the guidelines say teachers can't use the fans to circulate air, only to blow it out. With kids wearing masks, how is this going to work? And then how do you encourage kids, especially little ones, I guess, to keep their masks on? It just seems like a pretty tough challenge.
It is. Well, one thing I'll tell you is talking to a number of the other states, they're saying for those warm days, maybe some of those classes can take place outdoors. And perhaps that's a chance to take your mask off to give you a little bit of a break. That doesn't work as well in November, but it might work pretty well in September. And there'll be other chances over the course of the day to take a break when you're outside as well. So it's not like you're going to have a mask on for 6 straight hours.
And I just had a quick question on the contact tracing. If you hear about, say, a person that's infected in a place of business, whose responsibility is it to contact authorities?
Well, I'll start with that. I mean, Josh and I were just talking about this. If it's at a university, if it's in a classroom, if it's at a place of business, if it's at a manufacturing site, obviously everybody there located has an incentive to make sure that person who's infected is immediately quarantined and do the contact tracing. I'd like to see those entities take the lead on doing it themselves, since there they are local and they're in the best position to do it. Otherwise, we're there with our contact tracing people to back them up and make sure it happens.
Yeah, and as the governor said, our local health departments and local health districts are the front lines for contact tracing. They know their communities best. They know the people. They know the restaurants and the other facilities. So they are on the front lines leading the contact tracing effort, and we really want to thank them. I mean, they've been working incredibly hard. Learning a new process and a new system in the midst of a pandemic is no easy task, but we now have 100% of the local health departments on the contact system, which which gives us a huge advantage as a state to be able to pass contacts across jurisdictional lines to get insight at a statewide level of where hotspots or outbreaks might occur. So they've done a great job, and in that type of case you just described, they would be on the front lines helping to investigate that.
But how would they hear about it?
Well, it needs to be reported, right? Either through the facility itself or through the contact tracing investigation, right? You get the positive case, you talk to that person, you interview them, you find out where they had been, who they might have been in contact with, and you follow the leads from there.
Okay, thank you very much.
The Day of New London.
I just wondered now if, given what the case numbers are, whether we're at the point where we can say definitively that in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests and the first couple of phases of reopening and whatnot, we were worried about seeing a spike. Have we not seen that spike? Can we say that yet?
Well, it's always too early in the COVID crisis, but I would say that we've not seen a spike, and I haven't heard from other governors they've seen necessarily a spike from the nature of those outdoor rallies. And I think the fact that it's outdoors, the fact that a lot of people were wearing the mask has made a big difference. Does not mean anybody's out of the woods, but I think there's a much greater risk of what happens indoors.
All right, thank you.
The Waterbury Republican American.
Thanks. Sorry about that. Governor, can you give us an idea when you might be making any decision on moving to the third reopening phase or a new version of it?
Well, we usually change phases every month or so, and we usually try and give Paul notice at least a couple of weeks in advance. So I think that would still be more or less our time frame. But as Josh reminds me, our metrics are not, I'm not sure what we're going to learn dramatically different in 2 weeks that we don't know today, but that's generally been what our schedule has been.
And if you're only getting 50% or less than 50% response to contact tracing inquiries, how much confidence should people have in the contact tracing system? I mean, it's, and its purpose.
Well, I'll start. I mean, it's certainly it's 50% better than zero. We have been able to head off. You know, I understand there was one person we found that had been in contact with 13 people. So you know, we hopefully saved a lot of potential infections there. That's why we are still focusing as part of the smaller groups, 25, 100 outside maximum. That's why it's really important. It allows us to maximize. But your point is well taken. If we could get 100% of the people to take our call, take our text, we would be in a much better position to contain this virus.
Yeah, and I'd also just point out, we've been benchmarking those metrics against other jurisdictions that share data. There's actually very few that do share data like we're sharing. We've been trying to be very transparent about all of our COVID data throughout this. But we looked at New York City as an example, who's been doing this for a while, Massachusetts. And that ratio of about half of the cases that you're able to contact actually responding and participating in the interview seems to be very consistent. So we're working together. We're trying to collaborate on process improvement, other things we can do. But the most important thing just for everyone out there is if you see that CT COVID trace come up or you get a phone call from your local health district or the state, please take that call. It's how we can all do the small things that help keep our numbers in a good position and help us keep Connecticut open.
And the appropriate, excuse me, someone else? No. Anyway, the Appropriations Committee today had a heard from the Judicial Department, and the Chief Court Administrator was a little concerned. Apparently, they've requested $4.3 million in coronavirus emergency funding, only been allotted $1.2 million to date. He's also sort of surprised, taken aback that apparently there was a pool of $5.8 million and out of 12 or 13 departments that sought funding, only the judicial branch was denied a request for, I believe, about $218,000 for a call center.
I got some of that. It was as regards the COVID relief fund money and the judicial branch. I can tell you that Melissa and I have not yet allocated the $1.4 billion. We've made some preliminary allocations. We got from municipalities what they're going to need. We're hearing from the schools what they're going to need. We'll be working very closely with judicial as well to make sure that we can stretch that money and they're able to open safely.
So in the news, what happened a few days ago? The decapitation of a statue that happened in Connecticut. This, of course, the Christopher Columbus statue in Waterbury. One organization not happy about that, the local chapter of Unico. And Francine Nito is joining us on the line. She's the chapter president to talk about this, and I guess a reward that the chapter is putting up here. Francine, hi. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you this evening?
I'm good. Thanks for hanging in, checking in with us after a day of work. We do appreciate it. Francine, before we get to what happened, please talk about Unico, UNICO. What's the organization about for people who don't really know about it? They may have just heard it and say, you know, what's this Unico thing? Talk to us a little about that.
Thank you. Unico is the largest Italian-American service organization in the country. It is a service organization similar to the Rotary and Kiwanis organizations. It was actually founded in Waterbury, Connecticut in 1922 by Dr. Vastola, who was denied membership into another service organization simply because he was Italian. And instead of saying, forget it, you know, I'm not going to help the community, he decided to create his own organization to address issues not only surrounding the Italian Americans, but to make positive contributions and promote positive imagery of the Italian Americans, and just to make the community a better place and engage in cultural, charitable, and educational opportunities for everyone.
You know, Francine, I have a lot of listeners in the Waterbury area, and I've already heard from a couple of them today who have sung, when they heard you were going to be on, they've sung the praises of your organization, particularly with a lot of things you're involved with in the greater Waterbury area.
Yes, I mean, locally, our chapter is very active. Like you said, I mean, we are the birthplace of Unico. So we've been around since 1922. We raise funds for the local soup kitchens. We give out over $15,000 a year in scholarships. We just, since February 1st, we've donated over $8,000 to the community through our soup kitchens, shelters, frontline workers, to the statewide Connecticut Food Share Program, but also there's other chapters throughout the state and throughout the country, and we contribute heavily to the Jimmy V and St. Jude's Hospital for Cancer Research. We do educational opportunities and mental health grants that we reinvest back into each local community.
Okay, so let's talk, Francine, and Francine Nito is the guest from the Waterbury chapter of Unico. Francine, let's talk about that statue. First of all, can you give us a little bit of a brief rundown for folks who are not in the general Waterbury area, what the statue is, where it was, and a brief kind of history of that statue in Waterbury?
Okay, well, Christopher Columbus statue in Waterbury was dedicated in 1984. A committee of Italian-Americans was formed, and they raised money from the people and organizations to commission, erect, and then donate the statue to the city. What we like to say about our statue is that it was a gift from the little people, because no one person or one organization could give more. We maxed out the amount of donation you could give at $1,000. So everyone felt that they were invested into the statue. There's no names on the statue. We did not thank anyone on the statue. The statue is totally a gift from the people in Waterbury to the city, thanking them for the opportunities that they provided to the city, to give our thanks of being Americans and just being happy to be able to participate and live in this great country of America.
So, Francine, from your point of view and of course, you could probably tell by my last name, I'm Italian 100%, but
yes.
But as an objective point of view here, Columbus really has been, ever since Italians came here to the U.S. and Columbus Day was approved as a holiday, the image, the story of Christopher Columbus has kind of been an image of Italian national pride, has it not?
It has. I mean, and you know, his story has been exaggerated. You know, they wrote this, the poem, you know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And, you know, we know the truth and, you know, that maybe he didn't set foot in America. However, he was our, not role model, but he was given to us as our hero. At the time when they started with the talks about Christopher Columbus and Columbus Day, it was just after that huge mass lynching in New Orleans of 11 innocent Italian-Americans, and there was a big uproar, and it was kind of the government's way of appeasing not only the Italian-American community, but the immigrant community to say, hey, you know, you're part of us, and we understand, and, you know, it was to recognize the achievements of the explorer who actually founded the first permanent European settlement in the New World. So it's the beginning of, you know, recorded history in America. It opened up the relations between Americas and the rest of the world. So it's not only about Italian-Americans. It's about any immigrant who came across the ocean from Europe and or from anywhere, actually. He is the epitome or the depiction of the immigration experience.
Francine, hang on. We're going to take a break. We're going to be right back with you. We'll talk about what happened to the statue. Understand there's no a reward being floated by you folks. So stand by, please. Francine Nito is the guest. She is the chapter president of UNICO, an Italian fraternal organization. Now it's nationwide, founded back in Waterbury in 1922. Francine, back with more with you after traffic and weather together, 516 on WICC. And we spend a couple more minutes with Francine Nito. She is chapter president of the UNICO chapter in Waterbury. Actually, UNICO, a national organization, started in Waterbury back in 1992, an Italian fraternal organization, talking about the vandalism that happened, the beheading of the Christopher Columbus statue a few weekends ago a few days ago, before the weekend in Waterbury. Francine, let's talk about your organization's reaction to that. And do I understand correctly that you're offering a bit of a reward for any information leading to whomever may have done this? Talk about that.
We are. There is, in this community, there's been some talk and some demands of the mayor to remove the Columbus statue. There was a change.org petition and calls into his office demanding that he removes the statue. The mayor stated on two public occasions that he was not going to remove the statue out of respect to the Italian Americans. It was a gift to the city. And so the Italian American community, we started our own change.org petition, and we had over 2,000 signatures indicating that they would like to keep the statue in front of City Hall. That being said, there was a couple rallies this past week, and Friday night going into early Saturday morning, Independence Day, someone came through in the middle of the night and decapitated the statue. It was a terrible call to receive on Independence Day. You're supposed to be celebrating America, and to us and to a lot of people in this area, Columbus represents America. And it was just heartbreaking, and it was scary, first of all, that someone would deface public property, and the fact that they took it upon themselves when we had this peaceful and method of trying to get the information and hopefully coming to some type of compromise or community discussion. You know, an act of violence like this is not appreciated on either side. So the statue was beheaded. Luckily, they left the head behind, so it is repairable. And UNICO, who was spearheaded the committee, you know, to erect the statue, we're offering a $5,000 reward for any information leading to the arrest. We posted that on our Facebook page. We're getting positive and a lot of negative comments about that, how we should rather use that money for good as opposed to promoting evil. We have not responded to those directly, because if they knew anything about UNICO, they would know that that's all we do in the community is good. And Columbus, what he represents to not only us, but to the community, is good. And that's what we're trying to focus on. And violence is never the answer.
$5,000, if anyone provides you, obviously, with information leading to the arrest and conviction. Is there any indication yet, and Francine, and I know maybe you can't say anything, but is there any indication yet that the reward is, or the offer of the reward is at least eliciting information or not?
I you know, if anyone sends in information to Unico, we refer them directly to the Waterbury Police Department. Waterbury has a top-notch police department, and they are on the case, you know, and so we trust that they will be able to either provide an answer or solve this crime fairly quickly. Like I said, violence is never the answer, whether it's against one group of people or another group of people. That is not what we promote. And all we want is justice to be served and to recognize that our community does not support violence.
The Facebook page,
our community, Waterbury.
The Facebook page, Waterbury Unico. It's UNICO, Waterbury Unico. And would that be the spot people could go to, Francine, to give information and or find out more about your organization?
They can find out more about our information there. They can find out also, people also were calling wanting to know if they could contribute to the restoration fund. We provided our information if they wanted to send any tax deductible donations to the organization to be used just for this purpose. And we'll have more information on that. We don't have any definite plans. You know, this just happened on Saturday. And so once definite plans are announced of what the next step will be, we will have that information out to the public as well. We're encouraging anyone, though, with any information on this crime to do what they would do with any crime, is to contact our Waterbury Police Department or our Crime Stoppers unit.
All right. Francine Nido, chapter president of Unico in Waterbury, a nationwide organization. Founded in 1922 and has spread all across the country. Francine, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And we'll encourage folks to either give the information on the Facebook page or contact Waterbury Cops. Thanks, Francine.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Francine Nido from Unico, UNICO, in Waterbury.